our one interview with Joseph R. for Russell Burgard. It's 7/29/76, July 29th, and it's about 20 minutes to 8 in the evening, and we're with Mr. Burgard, and my wife Marie's here with me, and we're in his living room in West Los Angeles, and we're talking about this Western Electric receiver. The remote control unit for the Western Electric receiver was located on the control panel in front of the co-pilot seat, and I mentioned that the receiver could have been installed below the co-pilot seat. What do you say about that?
It seems to me that was a pretty standard location for one of the receivers. It seems to me as a communication receiver under that seat.
Any idea where the transmitter would have, standard place would have been?
I see it back in the tail, but I think I'm confusing it with a Model 14, because the most of the equipment, the 14s, were after the restroom.
Okay, well, it's back in the cabin somewhere.
Someplace in the cabin, I think, yeah.
Do you recognize this here at all?
That's a tuning crank for a receiver of some kind. But what one? Don't ask me.
Would that have been that direction finder receiver?
It's very possible.
Is it possible that that could have been a channel selector for the radio transmitter?
No, I don't think so. It wouldn't be that kind of a crank, that kind of a dial or handle. Channel selector would be a knob. A detent knob, I think, with numbers surrounding the knob.
Of course, it's from very early days. And
well, I realize that, but that would indicate a variable setting. And I know that the transmitter was crystal controlled and would be either set by a mechanical... a knob turning mechanical connection of some kind. I don't think it was motor driven, because I think that the motor driven channel selectors came out with a TA2 Bendix TA2 transmitter, and I don't recall this original transmitter that was in her crack.
Okay. Well, now Western Electric may have installed this gear. But when Remlin came out with the direction finder and the new RA1 receiver, which were companion units, the newspapers at the time said that Lockheed installed it. And that would have been in the first part of March 1937. And that loop was installed right up above her head here. And the problem is that there was no remote control unit for that RA1 receiver, and it was a pretty big unit.
Mm-hmm.
That RA1 receiver was half as big as this chair.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Now, where in the world, in that cockpit, could you have installed it?
Well, you mean the control, the tuning control?
No, it had none. The RA1 was a complete unit in itself.
Yeah,
did not have a remote control unit for it. There was no such thing. That wasn't developed until later. When he shipped the thing out, the unit had to be installed in such a way that the radio operator could get at it. Now, when they flew the airplane to Honolulu, Amelia wrote in her little notebook that Manning was working the radio over her shoulder. But where in the world could they have that's a small cockpit. Could they have installed that radio?
Don't have any more cockpit
pictures, and they would have taken the old Western Electric radio out. She only had one receiver. You only have so... And they took one antenna off completely. And the only antenna they had left was the starboard antenna, which you believe was a sense antenna for the direction finder so that they could solve the lateral bearing.
That's what I suspected it to be. This is starboard side, isn't it?
Yes, she's sitting in the co-pilot seat.
Yeah, that's what I thought. So that would mean that the receiver, if he was tuning the receiver over her shoulder, it'd be over here in the...
Well, no, she normally sat on the left side. Whoever took this picture, see, this is just a blow-up of this picture, was shooting through the channel. So she'd have been here, they couldn't have saw anything, so they moved her over in the co-pilot side just to...
Yeah. So that's why I say that the receiver would have been over here in the on the...
No, normally she sat in the other seat.
Yeah, the left side.
Yeah.
Yeah. But here we're looking
at the
right
side. He had to be in the center. He couldn't have reached over.
From behind.
From behind, Paul Mance was in the other seat.
Oh.
Mance was in the right-hand seat. This was en route to Honolulu on the first trip. And she wrote in her notes that Manning reached over her shoulder to work the radio.
Hmm. Boy, it leaves me blank.
Well, is it possible that Bill Burrows did the installation? You were busy with something else?
Well, anything is possible.
Biff Marshall said that he didn't have anything to do with it.
No, I don't think he was working with us until after
the antennas.
That.
Well, no, he was there then, but he was the flunky.
Yeah.
He did all the heavy, dirty work, and he didn't get to work on Amelia's airplane very much. That was for the big guy, you. He was just kidding. But he said mainly he swept the floor.
that's not really true. But I just can't believe how dense I am as to the location of those things. But I didn't really do an awful lot of work on her aircraft, as I recall. I remember working in a junction box after the cockpit wall. I think long before the tanks were installed. And that's where I recall scratching my name on the inside of the lid of that junction box before I closed it up.
Do you remember how you scratched the name?
I don't remember whether I wrote it in pencil or scratched it with a scribe of some kind. But I just recall putting my name inside of it. And it's a big thrill. My name's going around the world, you know.
Did people call you Joe? Was that your nickname?
Yeah.
They didn't call you Blue Eyes, huh?
No.
I guess they saved that for Frank Sinatra.
Yeah, that's Frankie boy.
All right, well, now you mentioned that. Can you remember anything else like that? Can you remember anything about Amelia, what you thought about her, what she was doing? Respect her, or did she go away? Or?
Not really. I very vaguely recall, what's his name, her husband?
G.P.?
Yeah, Putnam. I recall seeing him once or twice, I think coming out to pick her up or something like that. But as I said, I never was around her enough to really become acquainted, never talked to her, unless just to say hello or something like
that. Did you talk about the radio installation at all? Because this is something a pilot's always interested in.
No. Well, you know, that's something that I used to get frantic calls from the line. The radio won't work, you know. Mm-hmm. And 90% of the time it was cockpit troubles. Pilots weren't that interested. Now, I don't think I was in the position to talk with her about the installation problems, particularly, or usage.
When you cracked up in Honolulu and they sent the airplane back, do you remember that it came back in for a major repair?
Well, if you recall, I told you about the note I made, rebuilt. Yeah, after it was rebuilt. And I didn't remember what had happened to it.
Do you remember at all what work you had to do on it as a radio man?
No, I don't.
Do you remember whether they installed maybe a Bendix transmitter instead of that Western Electric transmitter at the last minute?
No, I really don't.
Do you remember what gear at all was installed in the airplane. What radio gear she had. You know, because they called back to the factory, and they must have consulted either with you or Red about whether she could transmit on the water or not.
Oh, that doesn't mean a thing to me.
The Lockheed engineers stated that no, when once that airplane hit the water, there was no way that she could transmit.
No, because she wouldn't have any antenna. It'd be grounded, be in the water.
Plus the battery was down underneath the,
it'd be drowned.
The bottom of the airplane.
No, that's pretty obvious. I'm sure that she wouldn't be able to transmit after hitting the water.
Did you know, I'm going to talk to you just about as a radio man. You saw that loop, and it was about a 14-inch diameter loop, 15-inch diameter loop. Pretty standard loop first day, and they had made a matching box for it so they could couple it to the RA-1 receiver. And her receiver covered in five bands from 200 kilocycles right up to 10 megacycles. And Joe Gurr instructed her in how to use the direction finder. And he remembers that he tuned in KFI while the airplane was sitting on the ramp over Burbank and had her take bearings on KFI. And KFI, I think, is 740 kilocycles or something like that. Or, I don't know. It's a clear channel station. 540. And whatever. And it worked real well and took good bearings. And then going to Honolulu, she took bearings on Mokopu Point, which was 290 kilocycles, and it worked real good for that. But she was of the impression that the direction finder would take bearings on any frequency that the receiver could receive on, up to 10 megacycles.
That doesn't sound right. Seems to me the direction finder is operated on the lower frequencies and standard broadcast bands. Yeah, I feel sure of that. Because that's the only thing they had to take bearings on were commercial stations, broadcast stations, not communication stations.
Well, although it's designed to take bearings on those lower frequencies,
it wouldn't operate on the higher frequencies.
What would happen when you got a signal in the higher frequencies and tried to take a bearing on it?
I just don't think it'd receive it. I don't know.
Well, you'd get the signal. I mean, you know, it would come in through the loop. Would you get a minimum?
I can't believe that the direction finder operated on anything other than the broadcast band. I feel pretty certain of that. I ought to know it for sure, as many of them as I worked with, but that's my very strong impression, Don.
Okay, well, I've talked to the Bendix engineers who designed it and whatnot, and they said it was designed to work up to about 1,450 kilocycles, and that's as high as we can.
That's the broadcast band.
Yes, from about 190 kilocycles up to about
40. Right. That confirms what I said.
Okay. What she was trying to do was HF direction finding was just coming into
it hadn't been born yet, really, I don't think.
It was just a gleam in somebody's eye, and it had been found out that HF direction finding wasn't all it was cracked up to be. In fact, we've backed off from it, and HF direction finding just isn't hardly done anymore at all, except for wild emergency stuff.
I don't recall ever working with it myself.
It was a great idea, and after trying it for a year or two, they found out it was full of all sorts of, of worms. Well, but at that time, it was being touted as the greatest thing since French toast. And Amelia going along with that theory and under the impression that the direction finder would take a minimum on anything that the receiver could receive, she asked the Coast Guard cutter, Atasca, which was at Howland Island, to transmit on 7,500 kilocycles for her to take a bearing on. And they did, and she came back and she said, I hear your signals, but I can't get a minimum. Well,
It wasn't designed for it, I'm sure.
So she didn't get a minimum, and therefore she never got a bearing on them.
Hmm.
And that was one of the reasons why she wasn't able to find the island.
Hmm.
Well,
very
plausible. I can't think of anything else. Can you think of anything, Marie?
No, you're out of my field. I don't know anything about radios.
You can't remember where that original direction finder, that was a very unusual plexiglass housing for those days, that mm-hmm. bubble, whatever it was, I call it plexiglass. There wasn't any such thing.
I didn't remember it until I saw it in the picture. I don't know where it came from.
Well, Bill Lear...
I was wondering about Lear. He was mixed up in the direction finder business and
right.
receivers along in those days, I know.
Well,
maybe a little later.
Bill and said, I'd like to have your... He had a Learoscope with a left mm-hmm. right needle, mm-hmm. and I'd like to have that for my wife's airplane. And Bill said, yes, that's real good, $186. And GP said, well, for publicity, we thought maybe you'd give us look, it's your wife, and it's a good direction finder, and if you don't want to spend the $186, I'm not going to spend it. And anyway, they got this other direction finder, and that's Bill Lear's story. But Bill thought it was somebody in Los Angeles here that was trying to pedal that direction finder at that time,
I don't think it was Stoddard. Who could it have been?
Do you happen to know Pat Hyland, Doc Hyland?
The old-time Bendix radio, you mean?
Yeah.
I never knew him. I just know the name.
He's general manager of Hughes Aircraft now.
He is?
Yeah.
Oh, he did.
He still is, running the whole show. He's 70...
I didn't know that.
He is the number one man in Hughes.
Huh.
He's running the whole shebang now, isn't he?
As far as we know.
Since Hughes died, he's it.
Oh, my God. That's interesting.
He's the guy
that...
I thought he was long gone, retired probably from Bendix many years ago.
Oh, he left Bendix many years ago, but he went to work.
No, I never knew him.
Well, he was president.
Johnny Hammond was one guy I used to work with at Bendix Radio, and
yeah.
I recall.
Well, you know, because they were working on that antenna, I wondered if they changed the transmitter to a Bendix transmitter before she went on the second flight.
Well, I wish I knew.
Because I know they changed the receiver to a Bendix receiver.
Hmm.
Can you think of anybody else? Go ahead.
Well, no, I was going to say that was around the time when Bert Hemingway came out here from Bendix and set up shop. I don't remember whether it was...
Is he still around?
No, he's long gone. He passed away. So is Winchell. But Winchell wasn't mixed up with Bendix in those days either.
Did Bendix in 1937 have a shop here? Because Colonel Remlin came out.
When was it? They started opened an office over in the old, I guess it was Northrop building. Wasn't it Northrop?
Across the runway 15 and the other side there.
Yeah.
That was a long time ago when Northrop was there, though.
Oh, yeah.
Back.
Yeah, it was in that building. They had the first office. And I first became acquainted with them. We were working hand in glove together. They were representing Bendix and the equipment, and I was working the installations. I try to remember. I went to Bendix in, I believe it was 40.
You remember the RA1 receiver?
Oh, yeah.
It was a great receiver. probably one of the best aircraft receivers ever designed for its time.
The RA-2 was a fixed channel receiver, wasn't it?
I don't know.
I mix them up now. For years, I had instruction manuals on all of them, and I finally dumped the whole works.
Well, you know, on the early direction finders that they tried to use for HF and for low frequencies, like the Coast Guard had a portable direction finder, they had two loops. They had one loop for low frequency, and then if they wanted to use it on the high frequency band, they had another loop. Because the impedance and whatnot just didn't match. The windings had to be different.
I just don't recall messing around with direction finder on
manual. I'm going to read you some names of people who might have had something to do with it, and if you know any of these people, speak up.
Okay.
Carl D. Remlin, E. B. Hart, Malcolm Taylor, Al Hemphill.
I remember Al Hemphill. It seems to me he worked in my crew at one time. Didn't he go get mixed up with Qualitron?
No, he stayed with Bendix, and he just retired last month.
No kidding?
Yeah.
I have him confused with
somebody. But he was
else.
With Hemphill clear back to the 30s, the radio research days. He started out with radio research. In fact, he helped design this direction finder unit.
Yeah, I remember the name.
W.P. Hillard. Chicago.
It sounds familiar, but I can't place him.
L.A. Doc Pat Hyland. Alfred Ney, N-E-Y.
Oh, I remember that name, too, but I can't place him. My gosh.
Herbert Sharlock.
No.
Joe Frabut, F-R-A-B-U-T.
Mm-mm.
Nate Brace, B-R-A-I-S. Nate
Brace. Brace. It sounds familiar, so I can say.
Okay. Well, those are some of the people that just... Or William Bill Willis.
Yeah, he was... I believe he was on some of the radio installation crew, too, but I... I just can't remember the...
Well, that's many years ago. Okay. I can't think of a thing else. I think I just... I don't want to tire you anymore. I sure appreciate your taking the time to see me this afternoon.
I wish I could remember so much more than I can about it.
Can you think of anybody that might have installed the gear if you or Red Burroughs didn't do it? Somebody had to install this gear.
Yeah, well, we had a fairly sizable crew at the time. Bob Saxon. I haven't heard of him in years.
Do you remember installing a CW key, or was it standard to have a CW key?
Not in that ship, I don't. I don't, just don't believe we did. Not lucky.
Okay.
I really don't.
During the initial construction of the airplane, after it was cracked up when it was brought back to Burbank, was there anything that was done, anything that you heard of, or anything that you ever suspected that airplane was going to be used as a camera ship or any sort of a secret intelligence mission of any kind?
No, nothing that I ever heard of.
Or suspected?
No. Never would have given it a thought.
Do you think she was just out to be the first woman to fly around the world?
I think so. I don't think there was any conniving.
Okay, if there was, you weren't in on that.
No, that's for certain.
Nor was Harvey Christen or anybody else I can find. So.
No, it just doesn't sound logical. Somehow.
Okay.
Did you ever talk to anybody that knew her or made any comments about her ability as a pilot?
No, not really.
When she was around, did she seemed to know what she was doing?
Oh, yeah. She was one of the guys when it came to that, it seemed to me. I never had any reason to believe otherwise. I think she was very confident.
She took careful note of what was going on.
That would be my impression, yeah. Yeah.
So she was pretty well in touch with everything.
I think so. She just wasn't a fly-by-nighter.
She pretty well knew what she was about.
I'm sure of it, yeah.
You remember her Cord automobile?
Oh, I didn't recall that she had a Cord. I remember somebody else that had a Cord, one of the test pilots for Lockheed. I think he came along later, though. I can't call his name right offhand. I didn't remember that she drove a Cord.
There was a Model 10A, a Model 10B. Basically, they just had different engines. The 10B had a Wright engine, and a 10A had a Pratt & Whitney Jr.
Mm-hmm.
And the 10E had the Pratt & Whitney Major S3H1 engine. Why did they... What happened to the C and the D?
You got some dandy questions, haven't you? I never heard of them.
There was no such thing?
Do you remember the XC-35?
Yeah, that was the first high altitude. Yeah.
Did you work on that at all?
Some. I at one time, I wish I knew where the stuff was. I at one time had a copy of the communications between Marshall Heidel and the ground, I believe it was.
On the XC-35 test?
On the XC-35 altitude test. But I...
You know, I wish you would somehow, sometime, when you get an opportunity, dig these things up and let me look at them, and also let me recommend that you do something with them. Let me make copies and turn them over to the Smithsonian or...
I'd be glad to if I could ever run across it. Whether I still have it, I don't know.
These things are great historical... You know, that airplane won the Codger Trophy for the year 1937 is the outstanding aviation.
Well, I recall that now that you mentioned it. But the only place I can imagine that I might have it, if I do still have it, is on the top shelf of a closet, and it's just impossible for me to get it down at the time.
Yeah.
I just don't have the strength to do it. I can't either.
Yeah. Well, you're going to get better.
Oh, that's for sure. I'm better.
How long ago were you operating?
In April.
Oh.
The first part of April. But as I said, I had a setback. I was going great guns a month later. Afterwards, we took off for the hills, and we spent quite a bit of time up in the Lake Isabella.
When you did those tests, and Heidel did those tests, were they done out of here at Burbank? Or?
Yeah, right off the old... The old field alongside the old original Lockheed buildings along the railroad track. That's where it was hangared.
And it was there and going through this test work almost all the time. Did you work in the airplane at all?
Not a great deal. Well, you mentioned Furman Gray. He was experimental foreman.
Shop foreman.
And the only reason I think I got mixed up with it at all was probably some of the radio controls, flexible controls.
Aaron's control.
No, not Aaron's, the other one. I can't say at the moment. Bowden. No, Aaron's, I guess it was, the one that rotated.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had them mixed up.
Well, were there ever any fuselage fuel tanks in that airplane? What I'm getting at, the airplane when you delivered it to the Dayton at Army Air Corps in those days, I believe, after you'd run the acceptance tests on it, I believe the airplane was delivered, and the Army Air Corps did some tests on it back in Dayton, Ohio.
Well, I don't remember anything about that at all.
Well, there's all sorts of people that are investigating all sorts of things.
Yeah.
And there is one school of thought that, I shouldn't say school of thought, I should say there's one school of people who insist that Amelia was flying a high-speed airplane capable of going all the way to Truk and down to Howland Island. And what she did was at Ley, New Guinea, she swapped the XC-35 for her standard Lockheed 10. And
oh, boy. That sounds pretty wild.
But that wouldn't have been possible, wouldn't it, without people at the plant recognizing the fact that the airplane was gone, or that tanks or special tanks that had to be installed?
I should hardly think so. I don't remember of any special tanks in that XC-35.
In fact, an experimental airplane like that is hardly any airplane you would go out flying across oceans with at first, because it probably didn't work very well at first because it had nothing but bugs in it.